You are listening to CFRU Radio, 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, and available worldwide at cfru.ca. This is a rebroadcast of the program Back in the USSR. This was originally broadcast on February the 28th, 2015.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Soul, I got to explain to you also your soul, your needs, your political desires and needs, because that is Huey's soul. When we first organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, he would say, Bobby, he says, we're going to draw up a basic platform, just basic, that black people can read. He says, we don't want to go real elaborate with all these essays and dissertations and all this stuff, because the brother gonna look at that and he said, man, I ain't got time for that. I gotta go see what I can do for myself. He said, just a basic platform that the mothers who struggle hard to raise us, that the fathers who worked hard, that the young brothers in school who come out of school semi-illiterate. You say, we want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community, full employment for our people. Number three, we want housing fit, decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. Number four, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. Number five, we want decent education for our black people in our community that teaches us the true nature of this decadent racist society, and to teach black people and our young black brothers and sisters their place in society, because if they don't know their place in society and in the world, they can't relate to anything else. Number six, we want an end to the robbery by the white racist businessmen of black people and black people in their community. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Because they have not had a fair trial, because they've been tried by all white juries, and that's just like being tried in Germany being a Jew. Number eight, we want black people, number nine, when brought to trial, to be tried by members of their peers, and a peer being one who comes from the same economic, social, religious, historical, and racial background. If the United States government and the courts and the local courts did this, they would have to choose black people from the black community to sit up on the jury. They'd have to choose some of the mothers who've been working 20 years in Miss Ann's kitchen scrubbing floors like my mother had done. They have to choose some of them hardworking fathers. They have to choose some of those brothers who stand on the block out there wondering where they're going to get a gig. They're going to have to choose these black people. And number 10, he would say, let's just summarize it. We want housing, we want clothing, we want education, we want justice, and we want peace. This is the basic platform. In case you never knew it or not, of all the things that you've heard in the press, of all the derogatory statements that's been made in the press about Brother Huey P. Newton and I, of all these derogatory statements to guide you away from seeing this basic platform that Huey was talking about for his own people. We have to learn to look through the white press. We have to learn to see what's going on. Now, out of this platform, Huey P. Newton realized that it was necessary for us to start working on these points, these 10 points, practically. Remember number seven? We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. This is very, very important. And here, whether you know it or not, is where you start dealing with the black revolution. When Huey says, every black man put a shotgun in your home. And once we let the man know, say, look, we armed from block to block, and we're going to patrol you from our windows. And we're not going to have you brutalizing none of our people in the streets. Do you realize what kind of power black people have then? Because you begin to neutralize that police force, because them cops gonna start riding shaky and scared. In fact, we're in a position then to demand that they withdraw from our community, because they occupy our community just like a foreign troop occupies territory. Very important to understand. We hate cops beating black people over their heads and murdering them. That's what we hate. If you got enough energy to sit down and hate a white person just because of the color of his skin, you waste a lot of energy. You better take that same energy and put it in some motion out there and start dealing with those oppressive conditions, and you're going to find out just what you hate and what you're going to stop. Racism. You dig it? When you stop racism, you stop brutality and murder of black people by the racist occupying army in our black community. That's what we're going to stop. What's being done to us? You dig it? Can you dig the white power structure and this racist police force and how they've escalated the situation? That before Watts, there was 1,300 cops. Now there's 6,000 cops patrolling black people. That in Oakland, they had 350 cops just 3.5 years ago. Now they got 1,000 cops patrolling black people. San Francisco's double its police force. And every area, major metropolis where black people live all across this country, they've doubled, tripled, and quadrupled their police force, equipped them with tanks, all kinds. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I'm Siegfried, and I never get tired of playing that clip from Bobby Seale talking about the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. I know I've played it on this show again and again, many times at the intro for the show, and just it's never inappropriate to play the 10-point platform of the Black Panther Party. Like, it's still absolutely relevant to this day. Of course, I've talked many times about what happened, of course, in Ferguson last year, and of course, the ongoing protests, Black Lives Matter, and the ongoing struggles of African Americans against the racist, you know, settler state, capitalist state in America, and how that goes on. You know, it's just as relevant as it was in the 1960s, that speech. So, it being the last day, and certainly went by way too fast, the last day of Black History Month, I decided I would be talking about the Black Panther Party and the kind of impact that it had on the African-American struggle for liberation, like in the United States, and the impact it had like on not only on the African-Americans, but also on, you know, other oppressed communities in the United States, and even on like poor working class white people, as I was quite surprised to find out myself, and also the impact it had internationally, you know, The Black Panthers certainly punched far above their weight, you know, and their influence is still felt to this day. So I thought I would bring somebody who is very knowledgeable on this particular subject in the studio to talk with me today. So I brought in a comrade from the Young Communist League. I brought in Brendan Campisi, who has been on the show before. It's been a while, I believe, Brendan. You were talking to Patrick last year while I was in China. About Gabriel Kolko, and the last time I think you remember, you were talking about the Korean War and the lead up to the Korean War and the Korean people's struggle for liberation against Japan and then ultimately against America.
So, yeah, that sounds about right. It's good to be back here. It's always good to be here on Back in the USSR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to have you back. So just to kind of give, maybe you could kind of just originally put it in context, how did the Black Panther Party emerge in the first place? Because, of course, we hear a lot, about, especially with movies like Selma recently coming out, and, you know, you hear a lot about, of course, Martin Luther King and the kind of the original protest in the civil rights movement and this sort of thing. We basically are told, but we're only told that, like, definitely one side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, we're not told about the emergence of the Black Panther Party and the kind of context that it emerged from. So maybe you could kind of elaborate on that.
That's a very good point. Hollywood doesn't really make movies about the Black Panther Party. The Black Panthers are in Forrest Gump, if I recall. And it's been a long time since I've seen that, but they're definitely not portrayed in any kind of positive way in what is a profoundly conservative film. But, yeah, it's a good question talking about where the Black Panther Party comes from. So the context for the emergence of the Black Panther Party is marked by a couple of things. As you said, this is the moment of the civil rights movement, or the moment after, in some ways, the civil rights movement. I'm going to challenge a bit of the framing of that in a second. But it's also the moment of decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
It's the moment of third world liberation struggles. It's the moment of the struggle of the people of Vietnam against the U.S. intervention and the puppet state in South Vietnam. Those are the two sort of fundamental conditions for the emergence of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party itself is founded in Oakland in 1966 by two community college students, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. But there's a bit of – and it, then it spends the next couple of years of its life mostly as a small local group in Oakland. Later, there's a chapter in Los Angeles. And it's not until the spring of 1968, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that it expands across the country. But before I talk about that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ideological and political prehistory of the Black Panther Party. And to do that, I'm mostly going to talk about Malcolm X and the impact that Malcolm X had.
Right.
So, as you mentioned, the civil rights movement, as it's commonly conceived, takes place in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And there is this incredible mobilization of the African-American people, mostly in the South, but also outside, and of white allies, for basically for legal equality and the end of legal segregation in the United States. And that's led by Martin Luther King and by mostly Christian reformist political forces. And then in 1964-65, the Civil Rights Act is signed, the Voting Rights Act is signed, legal segregation in the South begins to be dismantled. It actually takes a bit longer. It's not as if it just disappears in 1965.
Oh, yeah.
But legal segregation, formal segregation, begins to be dismantled. So the terrain of the struggle shifts a bit. It's worth noting that people participating in this movement didn't really call it the Civil Rights Movement very much, especially not at the grassroots. What they called it was the Freedom Movement.
Mm.
And the grassroots people, the farmers and workers in the South, Black farmers and workers in the South who were the backbone of the movement, didn't think of it as a movement just for the end of legal segregation. They called it the Freedom Movement, and freedom meant many of the kinds of things that Bobby Seale talks about in that clip. It means many things that were mentioned in the Black Panther Party program. It includes these economic demands. So the movement itself is kind of misunderstood. But in any case, a particular phase of that struggle does end in 1965. And then another set of issues comes to the fore, issues that are not so much the issues specifically of Black people in the South who've been living under formal segregation, but the issues of the millions of African Americans living in these large urban concentrations outside the South that have been created over the past few decades, the previous few decades, by the mass migration out of the South in places like Los Angeles and Oakland on the West Coast and in places like Detroit and Chicago and Gary and Newark and Harlem and Boston in the Northeast and the Great Lakes, basically. And that's the environment that the Black Panther Party will emerge out of. And so there's a new set of concerns. Police brutality is one of them. Unemployment is one of them. Those are probably the two most explosive issues. And from 1964 onward, there's this series of urban rebellions that start – the first prominent one is in Watts in Los Angeles in 1965 or 64. And this continues into the early 1970s. And so there's this very, very clear sign that there's this rage building that's been building up for a long, long time in these urban concentrations outside of the South, especially among young people. And at this point, you also have a new leader, a new political and ideological leader who comes into the sort of mass awareness of Black America and of eventually white America too, as somebody who can articulate the grievances behind this wave of urban uprisings and to start to try and articulate a political approach that will appeal to this particular segment of the African-American population and the whole community. And that is Malcolm X, who is a minister in the Nation of Islam, which has for a long time up to this point been a very conservative and essentially apolitical organization. For a long, long time, there was a formal rule against members of the Nation of Islam being involved in politics. And their solution to the problems of racism and oppression in Black America was essentially a moral redemptive program whereby Black people would overcome the psychological and cultural and moral symptoms of living in a racist society on their own without basically changing the political circumstances, which is essentially in the hand of God. So that's the program of the Nation of Islam up to a certain point. But then Malcolm X starts to develop a more political version of this program. And Malcolm X begins to express a series of ideas that would ultimately be taken up after his assassination in 1965 by the Black Panther Party and by a younger generation of African-American militants. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what those ideas were because I think they're really important to understanding the Black Panther Party and its contribution. So the first three of these ideas can be grouped together, and those ideas are grouped together very immediately, and those ideas are self-determination, self-defense, and self-respect. Malcolm X talked about those things, the Black Panthers talked about those things. I'm going to pause and go into what each of those meant in a concrete sense in the situation of the Black Liberation Movement in America at this time. So self-determination basically meant what Seal explains in the 10-point program. We want the power to determine the future of our Black community. And there's this idea emerging that legal equality is not enough for Black Americans to solve the problems that they face. And relying on alliances with white liberals is no longer enough, especially when gains have been made in terms of formal equality, because white liberals are not interested in going any farther than granting Black people formal equality. So the idea emerges that for real lasting solutions to occur, Black people need to hold power where they live. They need to be in control of the places in which they live. And Malcolm X, in his really, really iconic speech, The Message to the Grassroots, talks about land and political power as being fundamental to the liberation of Black people. And within a few years, you'd have a really remarkable revival in the Black movement and the radical movement in America more generally of an idea that had previously been put forward by the Communist Party in the United States, which is that Black people were a nation with a national homeland in the South and that they should exercise self-determination in that territory. The Black Panthers never exactly held that view, but it was one particular articulation of the idea of Black self-determination. The fundamental idea was that Black people need to have power over their own communities and the circumstances in which they existed for any real lasting solutions to be found. And the second is self-defense. And self-defense is probably the single issue that gets the most attention from white scholars and the white popular media. And there's this when looking at the Black Liberation Movement at this time, and there's this very entrenched framework of King and the pacifist Christian civil rights movement and Malcolm X and the Black Panthers who were violent. That's a really, really, really fundamental misrepresentation in a number of ways. In the first place, self-defense, including armed self-defense, was an essential part of the civil rights struggle in the South. It was an essential part of the freedom movement in the South. And in rural society in the southern United States, it's simply a fact that people are armed. And that included Black people as much as it included white people. And that was a necessary thing, because if you study the movement a bit, then you'll start to learn that even these struggles for formal and legal equality were faced with terrorism from the Klan, from other white racist terrorist organizations, and from the police. So people needed to protect themselves. The young, idealistic student activists who did have these pacifist convictions, white and Black, who went down to the South to register people to vote and to do this kind of work, could never have done it if they weren't being protected by the local rural Black people who were always armed and always ready and willing to protect themselves with arms. So, but then on another level, it's always been wrong to say that Malcolm X or the Black Panther Party or the militant section of the Black Liberation Movement in general has ever advocated violence, because they simply never advocated violence. What they always advocated was self-defense. And the basic fact of the matter is that white America and the American state are violent. The United States is a violent society. And the American state, of course, is an extraordinarily violent institution. King called the American state the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And he was, of course, right about that. And it's in that situation that a section of the African American movement was willing to politically say that it was necessary for black people to defend themselves when they were being attacked. And if you look at the situation today with this enormous struggle going on around police brutality, there have actually been – that call has actually reemerged in certain quarters to take up armed self-defense. And it's hard to see it's not hard to see why that would when the police are the ones who are attacking black communities. And it was a very, very similar situation, of course, that the Black Panther Party emerged out of. And they took up that program of self-defense in a very concrete way, as Seal describes, and took up the work of attempting to defend black communities from racist police. So that's self-defense. It's always necessary to clear away the myths around violence and self-defense in the black liberation movement. And the third is self-respect. And this is very, very important. Because one aspect of the experience of racial or national oppression that it can be easy to lose sight of from the position of, you know, outside supporters or people who are sort of studying this in an abstract way, for those of us who don't experience it, is the psychological dimension and the internal dimension that has to do with the self-worth and the self-respect of oppressed people. And Malcolm X very, very forcefully advocated the reclaiming of dignity and self-worth for black Americans. And you can see where he drew on the program of the Nation of Islam there, because they believed very strongly and they attempted to put into practice building up the self-worth and the dignity of black Americans. Malcolm X basically took that and politicized it. And of course, there's this enormous cultural movement in black America at the same time. People began to change their names, rejecting slave names, rejecting Christianity. People took up what they imagined and at the same time sort of created forms of African culture, African dress and African names, especially Swahili mostly. And people took up Islam, both in the unorthodox forms of Nation of Islam and mainstream Sunni Islam, which, of course, Malcolm X turned to at the end of his life. And the Black Panthers, for the most part, were never really into that. Especially the leadership in Oakland, they were very, very secular people. And they called that kind of cultural movement, they referred to it as pork chop nationalism, specifically a reference to Islam, of course. And they didn't see that as being any kind of real solution or having any sort of real importance to the political struggle. But at the same time, if you look at the art of the Black Panther Party, the iconography of the Black Panther Party, and the way the images that the leaders, the leadership of the party, people like Newton and Seal and Cleaver were able to create for themselves, they were attempting at the same time as all this was going on to instill a sense of dignity and self-worth and pride in black Americans, especially in black American men. A lot of this was done in a very particularly gendered way. It was particularly geared toward men. But yeah, that's the third point being self-respect. So those are three of the essential contributions that Malcolm X first articulated in a way, and the Black Panther Party would later take up. And there are two more. One is connected to the idea of self-determination, and that gets into the issue of who are the African American people, in the sense of what is the basic situation of this group of people and their relation to the rest of the society in which they live. And in the time of the Civil Rights Movement, as we've been discussing it, the political forces leading that movement, you know, people like King, had basically a conception of the African American people as a minority within American society who had been excluded from full participation in that society by unjust discrimination. But Malcolm X rejected that view entirely. And he said that black Americans were not effectively Americans at all, that they were a nation, a colonized nation, living within the borders of the United States, essentially kept within American society by force. And he – probably the most sort of popular way he expressed that, he said, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that gets at a historical truth, which is that people of African descent were never intended to be full members in American society. They were, of course, brought to the United States purely to serve as a slave labor force, and were only ever formally, you know, only formally became citizens after the Civil War, after the United States had existed for decades as a nominally democratic society from which they were completely excluded. So there's a very strong historical basis to the argument that African Americans were never supposed to be included in this society. And the Black Panthers took that up. And they also took a very practical suggestion from Malcolm X and advocated it in their own turn, which is that they should – the African American people should go to the United Nations and demand that the United Nations organize a referendum in which the African American people would be able to make – for the first time ever in their history, a formal political decision, a democratic decision, about their relationship with American society. And there are other organizations, groups like the Republic of New Africa, that took that up at the same time. But we're going to have to leave them out. Although that's a very, very interesting organization. Mm-hmm. And the Panthers always had, you know, a much broader movement around them, of course. Yeah, self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense, and black people as an internal colony. Very, very important contributions from Malcolm X. Mm. And the last thing that I'm going to talk about in terms of ideological themes that Malcolm X first articulated is what you could call third world internationalism. And just to go back to something that I said when I was describing the basic conditions of the moment that the Black Panthers emerged out of. And I said that it was the moment of decolonization. And what you have is over a generation starting, I guess, at the end of the Second World War with the independence of India and the revolution in China, is you have this massive earth-shaking change in the political situation of the formerly colonized regions of the earth where the vast majority of humanity up to 1945 had lived. In Asia and Africa and the neo-colonial region of Latin America. And there was an enormous amount of optimism at this time in the 1950s and 60s about the future of those societies. There was a sense that all the hope of humanity resided in those parts of the world. And the term third world, which today to a lot of people has very negative connotations, was meant to express that optimism. It was originally coined in reference to the third estate, the way it was spoken of during the French Revolution. What is the third estate? Nothing. What does it desire to become? Everything or something. And the third world was coined, the term was coined by analogy to that. And in 1955, there was the beginning of an organized third world presence on the world stage with the Bandung Conference, where the leaders of Indonesia, India, Ghana, Egypt, and Yugoslavia came together to start articulating the position of this section of humanity on the state of the world. And Malcolm X thought that was an enormously positive development. And he came to conceive of the world situation as being characterized by the escalating and increasingly successful struggle of essentially the colonized, dark-skinned majority of humanity, the black and brown majority of humanity, against racist imperialism. And that was his fundamental picture of the world. And he traveled to Africa. He met Nasser. He traveled to the Arab world. I can't remember right now if he ever traveled to East Asia, but he did at least travel throughout the old world, meeting these new nationalist leaders and attempting to get support for the African-American liberation struggle, which he was, you know, successful to an extent in doing. And this ties into the argument about the situation of black people, because not only did Malcolm say black people were not a minority in American society because they were a colonized nation, they were in fact, as far as he was concerned, not a minority in that they were part of the majority of humanity. Not a small group of black people in a continent dominated by white people, but a small group of black people in a world where black people, people of African descent and Asian descent and Native people in the Americas and the Arab people were starting to sweep away white racist imperialism and get rid of it for once, you know, once and for all. So there was an enormous optimism, and there it was an enormous sort of psychological boon to young African Americans to see themselves as part of this struggle where the Third World was moving forward all the time. And the Panthers contributed. The Panthers in many ways developed out of that, but they also contributed to extending it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's what I would say about where the Black Panther Party came from and what in terms of the political situation that they emerged out of and the ideas that that they tried to take up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play a clip from Bobby Seale, which kind of like speaks to some of the things that that you just spoke about.
Yeah.
In terms of the context they emerged from.
Okay.
And some of the history of, like, say, what happened in the early 60s that maybe kind of served as a catalyst in terms of, like, why African Americans believed that they had to change tactics.
Yeah.
Effectively. So this is Bobby Seale talking about no more shucking and no more jiving.
If I say I want peace, then you say you should put down your gun. But hasn't it occurred to you by now, after 400 years of being brutalized and murdered and lynched and maimed by guns and force on the part of racists and the racist power structure in this country, it's damn near time we picked up the gun to try to begin to get some peace, to defend ourselves and our community from racist attacks by the pigs, to defend ourselves against racist attacks by Birchites or Minutemen or Ku Klux Klansmen or what have you? Hasn't it occurred to you that it's damn near time we organize ourselves in some fashion to have some ability to begin to make racist and the racist power structure act in a desired manner as we define the functional definition of what power is? The ability to define the situation, and we have been defining it. Now we must organize in our black communities to also make the power structure and the racist system act in a desired manner. And what is that desired manner? Politics. What is politics? What is politics? You think politics starts with a seat in the assembly? No, it doesn't. It's related to it, but it doesn't start there. Politics starts with a hungry stomach. Politics starts with a pig crushing us across our skull and murdering our people. Politics starts with the fact that we get a rotten education, we get brainwashed and fooled and a trick notion and trick knowledge and everything else that goes on with us in terms of the exploitation that goes down. Politics starts with the fact that we want decent housing, fit for shelter of human beings. Now this is where politics starts. And black people now understand with the Black Panther Party that we are going to relate to politics in a real fashion. We are not going for no more jive verbal sincerity at all. Don't give me, Robert F. Kennedy, your jive shuck. I think it is necessary here that we come forth. I don't want to hear it. I'm tired of my black brother being brainwashed too.
Kingfish, what did you think about John F. Kennedy? Robert Kennedy?
Well, Andy, you know how it go there, boy. I think the boy is going to do something there. Look, we're not going for that thing anymore. Robert F. Kennedy was well related to Robert Williams being put in a situation where he had to vamp from this country and split because he was being prosecuted by Robert F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy did not send troops into Birmingham in 1963 until black people decided it was necessary for them to defend themselves. When Martin Luther King's motel was bombed and the races had been attacking us constantly in that particular area and all over this country, why didn't John F. Kennedy send some troops in then? He didn't send troops in until after black people decided we're going to defend ourselves from racist attacks and went to the streets and whooped up a few racist heads. Then John F. Kennedy decided to send in troops. See, all that verbal sincerity, we learn from the past. We learn. So we're going to guide our feet by the lamps of the past. And we're going to make sure that we won't fall into more bags. So peace and freedom, if you want to do something, get down to nitty-gritty and don't miss no nits or grits. No more shucking and no more jiving with the McCarthys, with the Lynching Baines Johnson, with the Governor Regans, with the Robert F. Kennedys, right on down the line. No more shucking and jiving.
Culture screwed, cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food, cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace, and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim, and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race. But no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling.
Candidate to hate, had to beat on the drum to communicate. For what was to come to those who were hung, they would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free, boom, me and Jamal. But two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery, but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats, segregated on wax. My color got me handy. Cap, Anus, and Andy for the freedom they just won't hand me.
Hold on to this feeling.
So true and they've been hurting so long.
Feeling.
That's the reason why we named this song.
Freedom.
Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and they've been hurting so long.
Feeling.
That's the reason why we named this song.
Freedom.
In the back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Jurassic 5 with Freedom, and of course we had Bobby Seale with No More Shucking and Jiving. And of course he mentioned like quite a few of the points that that Brendan was bringing up, right, in terms of he's looking about history. He's talking about the need of African Americans to defend themselves and like exert self-determination, and once again learning from their own experience, you know. And I want to mention that just last night I actually had a look at a movie which I believe you had the opportunity to go and watch earlier this week, Brendan.
Yes.
And that was the Black Power mixtape. And I guess this isn't like maybe directly like part of what we're talking about, but at the same time, like it does obviously fit in. When Angela Davis, like we talked about, like how you know, how violence is kind of you know, this kind of false dichotomy is presented to us,
yeah,
between like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and like the issue of violence. And basically in the Black Power mixtape, there's an interview of Angela Davis at a time when I believe she was on trial.
Yeah, it's from during the trial.
Yeah, when she was on trial, like basically a political prisoner essentially in the States. You know, the interviewer who was Swedish asked her about violence. And she basically said like whoever was accusing the African-American you know, Movement for Liberation of Violence effectively did not know what they were talking about, did not know the context of the American situation, you know, and the kind of violence, of course, the American state was using against them, and the need for self-defense. You know, they didn't understand that concept. And, like, really, that still is not understood by so many people today when they look at that, you know. Because, of course, like, and one of the last things I want to mention before we kind of get back into things with the Black Panthers is, of course, like, we mentioned just how the main problems that the people who joined the Black Panthers, who were inspired to join the Black Panthers, were facing was unemployment and police brutality. And, of course, we still see that in African-American communities today, you know, the whole movement around Black Lives Matter and all this, and the uprising in Ferguson, of course, highlighting these things. And, of course, now on top of that, we have the war on drugs and mass incarceration. You know, I believe Eddie Conway, who was, of course, a member of the Black Panthers in Baltimore, said the situation is even worse today than it was in 1968. So these things are still absolutely relevant to talk about. So to go forward from this, like, maybe you could start getting into the development of the Black Panthers as an organization.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, for the first year, maybe year and a half of the life of the Black Panther Party, they were essentially a local organization limited to Oakland. And most of the early work they did was around police brutality. Very, very basically, it just started with Newton and Seal engaging in a series of confrontations with police who were in the process of brutalizing and abusing and harassing Black people. And they took advantage of a particular California law that allowed the display and sort of open carrying of long guns as long as you weren't actually directly threatening anyone with them. And when that law was going to be changed, basically as a result of their work, a group of Black Panthers went down to the California legislature with guns and attempted to put on a bit of a demonstration and try and block the passage of this law. And that was unsuccessful, but it gave the Black Panther Party, for the first time, the formal name of which at this point was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which shows how fundamental that issue was. Later, the name would be changed. But it gave the Black Panther Party the first national publicity that it received. But the organization still developed fairly slowly after that. Sometime in 1967, a group was established in Los Angeles, but it didn't become a national organization until the spring and summer of 1968. And the main trigger for the national expansion of the Black Panther Party was the assassination of Martin Luther King and the wave of urban rebellions that swept the United States in the aftermath of that. And that was important on a couple of levels. One was that even though young African-American militants had been rejecting the ideas of nonviolence and integration that King had advocated for a long time, they'd been rejecting those things over the past several years before this, mostly under the influence of Malcolm X, the assassination of King was basically the final nail in the coffin of that kind of politics. It was very, very clear that if somebody's going to advocate peace and nonviolence and integration and they're going to kill him anyway, that gave a huge, huge boost to revolutionary politics in the African-American community and in the United States as a whole, which I'll get to. And more immediately, there was a wave of rebellions across the country. 70,000 soldiers and National Guardsmen had to be called out to suppress these riots, as, you know, of course, the state and the white media called them. And dozens of people were killed. There was enormous property damage. Buildings were being burned six blocks away from the White House. There were machine guns on the White House lawn because, of course, Washington, D.C. is not just the capital of the United States. It's also a city where the vast majority of people are Black and poor. And there was a large rebellion in Washington. So that was very, very symbolic, the fact that they felt that they needed to literally protect the White House and the Capitol building. And then in the aftermath of that, the radicalized and angry and politicized youth of Black America turned to a group that is putting forward a message that seems to – and that does speak very, very immediately to their concerns and their needs, and that's the Black Panther Party in Oakland. Newton, in 1967 already, was talking about trying to tap into the anger that was exploding in these rebellions and turn it into something more sustained and more explicitly and coherently political. And in the spring and summer of 1968, that started to happen. And the Panthers didn't even have to recruit. What happened was groups of young activists in cities across the country simply got themselves together and declared themselves, you know, the Kansas City Black Panther Party. And they would call up Oakland, and most of the time they'd get recognition. Sometimes they didn't, and the leadership in Oakland tried to keep things a bit more streamlined. But there was this very, very rapid and somewhat sort of chaotic process of this national organization being formed. And at its peak, it had several thousand members. I've never seen there doesn't seem to be a consensus on the peak membership of the Black Panther Party. You'll see numbers as low as 3,000, sometimes 7,000 or 8,000. In any case, several thousand people, the vast majority of whom were very, very young. Most Panthers were in their 20s or even in their teens. You can see that very clearly in any documentary footage of members of the party. So, yeah, that's the basic contour of a national development of Black Panther Party. And this sort of coincides with a number of other developments that would give them more of an impact, and that would enable the Black Panther Party to get more influence. And part of that, a significant part of that, was the continuing escalation of the war in Vietnam and the development of a radical movement among white students, which had its main organizational expression in SDS, in Students for a Democratic Society. And over the course of 1968, SDS starts to move towards the Black Panther Party, and many of these newly radicalized white students, many of whom had gotten into politics in the first place out of support for the civil rights movement in the earlier 60s, especially the older students and older activists among them, began to get more interested in the radical movement. And the Black Panthers helped to radicalize the white movement itself. And this is part of a long-standing dynamic of the African-American movement pulling white leftists and white radicals in America farther than they've previously gone. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee condemned the Vietnam War before SDS did. And they were fairly equivalent organizations in terms of their character. They were mostly organizations of students, and in the early 60s, those two organizations had similar politics. But the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was willing to take that radicalizing political step of condemning the war before SDS was. So the influence of of the Panthers on SDS a few years later was sort of a continuation of that dynamic. And one thing it's important to recognize, and it's really, really striking when you start to look into it, is the scale of the radicalization that happens in the African-American community at this point. One scholar sort of writing about this period, Max Elbaum, in his book Revolution in the Air, which is about the American revolutionary left in the 1970s mostly, but begins with describing the period of the late 60s, says that for a moment at least, revolutionary politics was not a minority position among people of color in the United States under the age of 25. It's very, very possible that in 1968, 69, 70, a majority of young black people in the United States believed in the need for revolution. And most of that is due to the efforts of the Black Panther Party in promoting revolutionary politics. So the scale of this is very important and very very striking, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like probably I should play like a clip actually from one of the one of these young people who certainly was part of the Black Panther Party and of course paid with his life ultimately because he was assassinated in Chicago. And of course I'm speaking of Fred Hampton, who's of course was shot by basically the I can't remember how many bullets the police sent into him while he was sleeping in a bed, but. Once again, you have like a very young person speaking very, very passionately for the cause of revolution in the United States. And
he's only 21.
He's only 21.
When he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think just to kind of capture that, I'm also going to play a clip from Malcolm X. And I think that's going to kind of capture really what we're talking about here. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pigs. The people are going to have to stand up against the pigs.
Back during slavery, when black people like me talked to the slaves, they didn't kill them. They'd send some old house Negro along behind him to undo what he said. You have to read the history of slavery to understand this. There were two kinds of Negroes. There was that old house Negro and the field Negro. And the house Negro always looked out for his master. When the field Negroes got too much out of line, he held them back in check. He put them back on the plantation. The house Negro could afford to do that because he lived better than the field Negro. He ate better, he dressed better, and he lived in a better house. He lived right up next to his master in the attic or the basement. He ate the same food his master ate, and wore his same clothes, and he could talk just like his master, good diction. And he loved his master more than his master loved himself. That's why he didn't want his master hurt. If the master got sick, he'd say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick?" When the master's house caught a fire, he'd try and put the fire out. He didn't want his master's house burned. He never wanted his master's property threatened. And he was more defensive of it than the master was. That was the house Negro. But then you had some field Negroes who lived in huts, had nothing to lose. They wore the worst kind of clothes, they ate the worst food, and they caught hell. They felt the sting of the lash. They hated their master. Oh, yes, they did. If the master got sick, they prayed that the master died. If the master's house caught a fire, they prayed for a strong wind to come along. This was the difference between the two. And today you still have house Negroes and field Negroes. Yeah. I'm a field Negro.
You have heard this poem before. You have heard the unoriginal, repetitious poetics of a shot, of a shot, of a shot, singeing the night air of shell casings on concrete, then cases of claims of standard police procedure, and cases of batons that leave red and white and blue on black, and bullets in brown bodies, and bullets in sleeping bodies, and bullets in running bodies, and bullets in bodies holding umbrellas, or holding pens, or holding other things that look like guns, or holding some last breath as if expecting dignity, service, and protection. This is another poem about police brutality. You will hear the same sets of metaphors once more. White security, verdicts of innocence, inconsequential bodies of evidence, ballistics and emergency lights, repetitious circling around and around like circular stories, like unoriginal poems, like a red stream of consciousness flowing through senses punctured, like sentences punctuated with bullet-like precision. Again and again, there is really nothing new here. This is as unoriginal as a mundane, untouched sheet of white paper or granddad's white clan sheets untouched in closets beside uniforms or uniform otherwise spotless police records. You have heard these stories before, I imagine. So why write? Why bother? Why do pens and tongues and lungs feel so heavy when stories seem to repeat themselves? Entertainment markets demand innovation. The same story again and again gets old, I am told. We'd rather plug our ears, and so there is silence in waiting for newness to appear. Silence. Like the eerie stillness of a loop, of a circuit frozen in time. Like prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to prisons to profits, to perfectly prosaic, perpetually profitable prison industrial strength. Complex loops like stock ticker tapes circulating at the bottom of TV screens. An economics of morbidity, a market that demands an endless supply of unremarkable names. Like Kenneth Chamberlain, like Rodney King, like Freddie Villanueva, like Amadou Diallo, like Katherine Johnson, like Neil Stonechild, like, are you tired yet? Yeah. and put down your scorecards. Set your aesthetics aside. There will be no originality tonight, because the same old stories out there mean the same old story up here. So this will stop being cliche when that stops being cliche, when cliches are no longer scripted in blood, stuttering his last breaths along sidewalks. Until then, chuck this up as one more outline, another empty shell of a thing, just one more, an original poem.
Bring that shit!
Hey, listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And once again, there's another piece I've played many, many times. That's another unoriginal poem about police brutality by David James Hudson, of course, of the Guelph Poetry Poetry Slam. And, of course, I also played a clip of Malcolm X, and, of course, another clip by Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party in Chicago. And we, of course, mentioned the brutal murder of Fred Hampton. And that was, of course, a segue into what we're going to talk about now with Brendan Campisi here on Back in the USSR, which, of course, is the American capitalist state's response to the Black Panthers and the their attempts to mobilize the African-American community. So we could start getting into that.
Sure. So as the segue there indicated, the main sort of character of the response of the American state to the emergence of the Black Panther Party as a major force in the African-American community and in the nation as a whole was repression. I believe it was in 1968 that J. Edgar Hoover declared the Panthers the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. And very quickly, they established a program, a national program of repression against the Black Panther Party, especially led by the FBI, but local police forces were involved as well. Every FBI station that was in a city with a Black Panther Party chapter was required to submit a report every 2 weeks on what they had done to disrupt the Black Panther Party. That is, I think, one of the clearest signs of how much of a priority suppressing this organization was. And there were assassinations, like the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago. There were attempts to stir up conflict between the Black Panthers and other organizations, like the cultural nationalist US organization in Los Angeles, led by a man named Ron Karenga. And the FBI managed to create an atmosphere of conflict between those organizations such that two members of the Panthers were killed by members of US on the campus of UCLA in 1969. And the tactics that they used in these attempts to disrupt the organization were really, really varied. They would, first of all, again, to create conflict between the Panthers and other organizations, one thing that they would do is they would send letters to Panthers and to members of these other organizations making accusations about the other organization, about, you know, it could be political or it could be something like marital infidelity. They did that within the organization. They tried to convince people who had reasons, who had personal grievances with other members, that that those other members were working against them. You know, maybe, again, it could have been a personal issue or a political one. It didn't really matter. And so they tried to foment splits. And there were political divisions in the party that would eventually, you know, undermine it in a significant way, especially after 1971. But the FBI was able to very, very skillfully play on those divisions. And they also had a tactic of basically locking up Panthers and accusing them of any crime they could be plausibly attached to, just to create a situation where the organization had to devote resources and time and money to getting people out of jail. It didn't matter whether they'd done anything. Sometimes they would pick something that somebody had actually done, so they would be able to put them in prison for some significant period of time. But even if somebody was simply arrested on a false charge and put through the whole system of having a false charge cleared, the whole elaborate process of having a false charge cleared, even if they were successful in doing that, that was a period of time when that particular Panther activist was not doing any political work, and when other people in the organization and allies of the organization had to devote time and energy and money to trying to deal with that. And that disrupted the work of the organization in a big way. And there were also routine raids of Panthers' homes, Panthers' family homes and sympathizers, Panther offices. There were some, like in Los Angeles, there were hours-long shootouts between the Panthers and local police and the FBI around their offices, because the Panthers, you know, they didn't just talk about self-defense. They carried it out, and they were always armed in their offices. They were always willing to protect themselves in their offices and their homes. And the FBI and local police were likewise always willing to basically to give them an excuse to have to defend themselves in a way. So those are some of the tactics of the repressive response. And there were also many leaders of the organization were driven into exile.
Right.
Eldridge Cleaver, who was the minister of communication for the party, was driven into exile in Algeria. Other people fled to Cuba. People fled to different sort of progressive and revolutionary countries in the world at that time. I'll talk about the Algerian